What the hell is tax reform anyway?
How do I maximize my super?
How does the exchange rate impact me?
What is negative gearing?
How can I stay out of debt?
What is a housing bubble anyway?
ASX, S&P, WTF?
Welcome to On The Money. We're here to delve into your finance questions and unpack the jargon around business, banks and big bickies.
On The Money, serving up finance in one easy bite.
Hello and welcome to On The Money. I'm Catherine Zangara. On the show this week,
what the government's challenge is to recognise that it cannot just pursue what's called fiscal repair, returning the budget to surplus, with one hand tied behind a back, which is about tax policy.
With rumours the federal budget will be brought forward, we find out what the community services sector wants to see from Malcolm Turnbull and Scott Morrison. Also,
the technology underlying is very smart, very valuable. Financial institutions started thinking, okay, can we use the same technology to regulate other kinds of transactions?
We'll find out what blockchain is and how it could transform our banking sector. That's all coming up. You're on the money. But first, March the 8th is International Women's Day, a time for women to reflect on how far they've come in the struggle for equality. One of the main campaigns on social media has been the Pledge for Parity. It's a push to close the gap between men and women's pay, which currently in Australia sits at 17.3%. The figure was outlined in a recent report by the Workplace Gender Equality Agency in collaboration with the Bankwest Curtin Economic Centre. One of the worst areas of pay inequality is the finance sector, where the gender pay gap is an astonishing 30%. And men earn up to $100,000 a year more than women in management. Rebecca Castles is Associate Professor and Principal Research Fellow at Bankwest and the author of the report, and she joins us on the line now. Good evening, Rebecca.
Good evening.
So why is the pay gap so high in the finance sector?
One of the things that is driving this is the different ways in which men and women work within the sector. So there is occupational segregation, and we know that women in the sector are more likely to hold positions in, say, the clerical and administrative roles, and men are more likely to be represented in the higher levels. So that's one of the drivers, but it's not the whole story.
So the work itself is gendered, and the gendered nature of that work dictates the pay gap.
That's right. It can, it's definitely one of the drivers. Another driver is the accessibility of these higher paying roles. So women, look at that occupational, we disaggregate the occupations within the sector, and we do find some interesting results there. So, for example, in finance and insurance, we see that overall their pay gap is around 35%. But if we look at some of the higher tier managerial roles, their pay gap comes down to around 23%. Now, that's still high, and we know that the top tier managerial pay gap is overall 29%, and it's around $100,000 a year. But finance and insurance services, I mean, they're still lower than that 29% for that key management personnel. The top tier management roles, they're at 23%. So I guess a bit more of a positive finding there, but obviously not one that you want to have continue in that sector.
So what's really going on here? Is it a boys' club? Are women afraid to ask for bonuses? Have we drilled down to get that sort of level of detail?
Well, one of the drivers is the accessibility. So if we take the key management personnel roles, now these roles are a very defined role. They're men and women working as chief financial officers, chief operating officers, human resource managers, and they're overseeing a very large division in an organisation. They're making management-wide decisions together with the CEO and reporting directly to the CEO. So you would expect that their level of responsibility and their experience is very similar, and that they're delivering similarly on their targets. So it comes down to potentially differences in the way certain roles at that level are valued. So you might see, for example, the human resource managers potentially having less value than the chief financial operators. And we know that women are more likely to be the human resource managers than the CFOs. But also the accessibility factor. So across the finance and insurance industry, the big paying roles, the big paying top tier managerial roles, women aren't able to access them.
So this really, sorry to interrupt you there, Rebecca, but this really is a cultural issue, is what you're saying, about how women's roles are valued.
I do think that is definitely one of the key drivers, the accessibility to these high paying roles, the value of similarly qualified and roles that require similar responsibility, but also when they do get into these roles, that they are more likely to be paid less than men, even if they are working across the same organisation. So we can see that in the data as well.
The ANZ recently started a campaign calling for an equal future for both men and women in the workforce. The campaign tagline says the system isn't actually designed for women to succeed. So would you agree with that then, based on what you've just said?
I think there's probably, that's one part of the story again, and probably what they mean by that is that potentially the caregiving role that women play a lot in society can impact upon their ability to then take on these other roles. I think that that's a story that is not necessarily, it's one we rely on probably too heavily. I also think this idea around, the system not being designed for women, I know so many hardworking women in these roles doing similar work to men. I don't understand how they can't be being paid or recognised in the same way as men they're working alongside of. One of the reasons that does come up a lot that's put forward is this idea that women do not request pay or negotiate their pay at higher rates in the way that men do, and that's why they often end up with the higher pay. And so they put the responsibility back onto the woman. I think that's a bit of a cop out, and I don't think firms, if they are doing that, and I know it is a negotiation process, but it is really getting to the point where the onus has to start coming back to the firm, and they do have to start thinking about rewarding people for the value of their work, not their ability to actually go in and ask for more money.
There are some publications that have suggested that the gender pay gap statistics are actually a myth, and that women get paid the same as men. They're just choosing to work in lower status jobs in lower paid industries. What's your take on that view?
I have seen that view. I've seen a number of articles that will talk about that as it being a myth. I think the data does show time and again that that's not the case. That the fact that they're not accessing these roles doesn't mean they're not applying for them and doesn't mean that they're not qualified to get them. So the companies that aren't actually putting these women forward, I mean, that's them diminishing their talent pool, really. Going back to this whole, it's the woman's responsibility, I think that, again, is a bit of a cop-out, and that we do have to start thinking about, well, why is it the women aren't accessing these roles? Is it because, they know that they're not going to be competitive because they do view it as a boys' club? Or are there other barriers that are preventing them from being able to access these higher-paying roles?
That's all we have time for, but thank you so much for joining us, Rebecca.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Rebecca Castles there. Rebecca is Associate Professor and Principal Research Fellow at the Bank West Curtin Economic Centre, and she's author of the Gender Equality Insights 2016 Inside Australia's Gender Pay Gap Report.
On the Money, hedge your bets and stay tuned.
You're on the Money with me, Catherine Zengra. Well, with the federal budget fast approaching, everyone wants to have their say on what they want to see in the federal budget, which may be sooner than we think. Rumours are flying around Canberra that the federal budget may be brought forward a week to the first Tuesday in May to make way for Malcolm Turnbull to call an early election. The 2014 budget was seen as unfair by almost everyone, and last year Joe Hockey's Have a Go budget focused heavily on small business and infrastructure projects in Northern Australia. So what are we going to see this year? Every week on the show, we're asking different interest groups what they think should feature in Malcolm Turnbull and Scott Morrison's first budget. Last week, we heard what women want. And this week, On the Money reporter Andrew Barclay caught up with the Australian Council of Social Services, known as ACOS, who've just released their budget submission.
ACOS is Australia's peak body for the community services and welfare sector, and the national voice for the needs of people affected by poverty and inequality. Alongside the trade union movement, they were the group who campaigned hardest against the cuts of the coalition's first budget in 2014. With an election likely to follow hot on the heels of this year's budget, what are they hoping to see? Here's ACOS CEO Cassandra Goldie.
Look, I think the federal government has to absolutely learn the lessons from the disastrous federal budget that was delivered by the coalition government in 2014, and to be serious about investing properly in where there are major gaps in services and making sure that there are tax changes in the budget that both improve the economic efficiency of the operating environment for businesses and others, but also to make sure that we have enough revenue to fund really essential services like health and education.
Cassandra Goldie says the government going down an austerity path in this year's budget would be bad for economic growth.
That's a shared message from all of us, I think, across the business community, the community sector and the union movement, to say we have to recognise that as a smart government, smart governments invest. They don't rip out the capacity for us to be able to grow the economy, but importantly to make sure our children have a good start in life, that we've got excellent education and healthcare systems, so that we have a really balanced approach to the budget.
Over the last year, there's been an ongoing debate about the kind of tax reform we need to either reduce the budget deficit or raise the kind of money we need to provide the health and education services Cassandra Goldie is talking about. Former Howard Minister Peter Reith says the government's on-again, off-again approach to tax reform now means there's nothing left on the table. He thinks this year's budget will be a do-nothing budget. But does Cassandra Goldie think he's right?
I certainly hope he's not. Look, the business community, ACOS and the ACTU, last year invested a lot of effort in identifying the common ground that we had amongst, you know, diverse perspectives about what needed to be done in terms of the fiscal agenda for the country and, importantly, the economic and social reform agenda. We've identified that on tax reform, for example, we need to be carefully going through tax concession arrangements like negative gearing, capital gains discount on investments, superannuation area, these kinds of tax concessions to identify where they are essentially not doing anything in terms of core purpose, in terms of the economic operating environment, so that we are closing down those ones that are essentially, they look great for people who could benefit from them, but they are essentially helping people on higher incomes to not contribute fairly to the tax base and not doing anything to the economy.
Cassandra Goldie says business, unions and the community sector are on the same page about the need for tax reform in the budget, especially in the era of superannuation tax concessions.
What the government's challenge is to recognise that it cannot just pursue what's called fiscal repair, returning the budget to surplus, with one hand tied behind a back, which is about tax policy.
One of the most contentious elements of the 2014 budget were measures to make it harder to access unemployment benefits, including a plan to make people wait 6 months for the dole. The government was forced to back down on this measure. Yet, in the mid-year economic outlook, they outlined a plan to crack down on welfare fraud, which they said would save $2 billion off the budget's bottom line. At the same time, ACOS was pushing to raise the unemployment benefits, which haven't been increased since the 1994 budget, 22 years ago.
In this area, we are again seeing essentially policy driven by ideology and a view that there is a fertile ground politically for sending a message to the community that the problem with the welfare budget is that people who are unemployed are lazy. Now, I'm sorry, but I think we underestimate the intelligence of people in the community. People in the community understand that it is really hard to find employment. I think post the GFC, where there was an absolute downturn in employers taking on new staff and workers, it has become harder and harder for people who lose their jobs to get back into employment.
70% of people who are unemployed have been so for more than 12 months. Cassandra Goldie says penalising these people won't help them get jobs. She says instead of spending on programs like Work for the Dole, the money could be better spent on providing incentives for employers to take on new staff.
Now, there's a consensus with the business community about that. So, again, today we say, why would the government not act on that consensus between the community sector and the business community, the representatives of employers and those that can't get work, to say, this is what we want you to do? I hope we'll see some of that in this federal budget, and I'll be very disappointed if we again get a backing of ideological programs like Work for the Dole, where there is no consensus outside of the government that it's a good thing to do.
Business groups, including AIG, the Australian Industry Group, have called for a tightening of expenditure in this year's budget, and Dr. Goldie agrees, but says it needs to be highly targeted to avoid pain for those who are most in need.
We also want to see spending tightly targeted. I mean, we know that there are big gaps in terms of the basic protections for people who are the most disadvantaged right now, and the level of the unemployment payment is one of them. You know, at $37 a day, it is not enough to live on. And so we are also carefully going through where there is expenditure to identify those areas where reform is required.
When Malcolm Turnbull took over the leadership in September last year, he promised a more collaborative approach and a new economic narrative. Despite early expectations he could deliver on this, the pundits are starting to question his ability to do so. But Dr. Goldie remains upbeat.
We were very encouraged by the early messages from the Prime Minister Turnbull of saying that he would work with the evidence, that he would develop considered policy, and if it was the right thing to do, he would prosecute the case for reform. I think some of the key examples of that are in these areas of tax reform like superannuation and negative gearing. The idea that because it might work in the short term as a scare campaign to say we won't touch these areas at all, when all the evidence says that they have to be reformed, I still want to be optimistic that at the end of the day, the government will recognise that and put together a decent budget.
CEO of the Australian Council of Social Services, Cassandra Goldie, speaking to Andrew Barclay about what they want to see delivered in this year's federal budget. Next week on the show, we'll be speaking to the Australian Industry Group to find out what they want to see from Treasurer Scott Morrison.
On the Money, dishing the dirt on your dough.
One of the reasons that Bitcoin has gained so much traction since its birth in 2009 is because its network has no single point of failure. People can feel confident that an earthquake in Asia, a power outage in South America, or political censorship in North America won't take the network offline.
That's independent Bitcoin journalist Amanda B. Johnson. Bitcoin is a form of virtual currency, now worth nearly $11 billion US dollars globally. It's been criticised for being unregulated by governments, for unpredictable currency fluctuations, and use in criminal activities, including drug dealing. Blockchain is the technology behind it. It's being hailed as a potentially transforming technology in finance and banking. Blockchain promises to make transactions faster and cheaper because it bypasses banks and records are kept only by users, not by a third party. Now, banks want a piece of the pie. So what does blockchain mean for the future of finance and how it will impact on the way we do banking? Vincent Su spoke to Marco Navone from the UTS Business School to find out more.
Blockchain is simply a way to regulate a large number of transactions. Okay, so whenever a lot of people are buying and selling something, you need somebody to keep a ledger, basically a bookkeeper who knows who owns what. If we have a certain amount of money and we start exchanging money, we need somebody to keep track. You know, how much money do you have? How much money do I have? And with blockchain is basically a very sophisticated technology that basically manages to do this.
So how does it relate to Bitcoin technology then?
Whenever people exchange Bitcoins, it's through the blockchain that you know exactly how many Bitcoins every person has. The thing that is different between the blockchain and traditional methodologies of achieving this goal is that usually you have a centralized ledger. You have somebody in the middle of the network, a bank, a central bank, an institution that keeps the ledger, keeps record of all the transactions. With blockchain, what happens is that you can get rid of this central intermediary, this central bank, this central subject who keeps the ledger, because every participant has a copy of the ledger. So the ledger is so-called distributed.
How did blockchain technology all start out?
That's very fascinating. Basically, it started with a white paper, with a working paper published in October 2008 by a guy called Satoshi Nakamoto. And nobody knows who really this person is. It's kind of a mystery. But this Satoshi Nakamoto published this working paper on the idea of creating a currency, a virtual currency, or what is called now a cryptocurrency. And in this paper, he also detailed the technology of the blockchain. So how to create a currency without the need of a central bank.
So blockchain started out with bitcoins. Can you explain how blockchain is being adapted for use with existing currency?
When people started looking at Bitcoin very carefully, they immediately realized that there is a technical separation between Bitcoins and the blockchain. So the blockchain can be used to regulate transactions on all kinds of things, among which Bitcoins. People started to say, okay, Bitcoins maybe will work, maybe will be successful, maybe will not be successful. But the blockchain, the technology underlying, is very smart, is very valuable. Financial institutions started thinking, okay, can we use the same technology to regulate other kinds of transactions? So, for example, the Australian Stock Exchange, the ASX, now is planning to study the possibility of using blockchain technology to regulate the transactions of stocks. So, in the future, maybe, whenever you buy or sell stocks on the Australian market, there will no longer be the central authority that keeps accounts and keeps the ledger of who owns which stocks, but will all be regulated with a blockchain.
So what's happening is that the role of banks and other financial institutions will change. So what exactly does this mean for the future of banks?
Well, the reality is that nobody really knows. Okay, so we are just in the infancy of this technology, and there are some financial institutions that are investing a lot of research in this. Others and some consulting firms that are saying, look, it's a very smart technology, but we'll never overtake the system because it has some limitations. So we don't really know what's going to happen. But what we can say for sure is that if blockchain becomes widely used to regulate financial transactions, you will have a smaller role for financial institutions whose job is to regulate these transactions. So basically, banks are going to lose a part of their business. Now, how fast this will happen, or even will this happen on a large scale, we still really don't know.
So in what ways could blockchain potentially change the way we handle our own financial affairs?
So far, the only applications that have been discussed between big banks and big financial institutions don't really involve final clients. They are basically being discussed as a way to regulate transactions between banks, among banks, not so much among clients. But you can imagine that the same thing could percolate down and maybe one day be applied on a larger scale on transactions between clients. Now, the good thing is that for the final user, really nothing changes, because it's like something that changes under the hood. So it's like you have a normal car with a combustion engine and then you move to a electric car. Well, the way you drive really doesn't change. Just the technology under the hood has changed. Now, if we start using blockchain, it could create an increase in efficiency. So, for example, what happens now is that even today, if you try to make a bank transfer at like, 4 or 5 p.m., the money will not physically move from, well, the money will never physically move, but the balance will not move from your account to the other person's account until the next day or maybe 2 days. Now, potentially, if the system was managed by a blockchain, the transaction could be much faster. Since you don't have the central bookkeeper, but everything is a network between participants, theoretically, the transactions should be faster, cheaper, And somebody also say more reliable. We still don't know about this reliability issue, but they should be faster. So what could happen for you is that whenever you transfer money from banks, or you sell stocks, or you buy stocks, it should be a faster and smoother process.
Will there be a need for a rethink in the way governments regulate the financial industry as blockchain grows in popularity?
A question that everybody is asking now is, when technology firms start playing the role of financial intermediaries in the market, because either they manage a blockchain or they manage a robo-advisor that tells people how to invest their money, etc., should the technology firms be regulated as financial institutions? And that's something that we still don't fully understand. It's a common theme in this technology disruption and revolution that we see today. It's the same thing when Uber starts playing as a taxi driver. If a technology firm that is not a bank starts playing a role that is similar to the role of a bank, should this technology firm be regulated as a bank? So that's the big question that I think will have to be addressed in the next years.
Well, given how transformative blockchain is hyped up to be, what are some of the problems that will need to be addressed before blockchain goes more mainstream?
Well, I think the biggest problem will be to set the standards, because the blockchain is a technology, but there are many decisions and many standards to be set. So now everybody is trying to apply blockchain in a slightly different way. So first of all, we will have to decide standards, for example, in terms of speed and reliability, etc. And then I think that one of the biggest problems that will have to be addressed is the one of responsibility, because nowadays we know exactly whenever we transfer money who is responsible for the transfer in every moment, who is there to certify that the money is physically present, etc. With the blockchain, we will have to solve these problems all over again and find solutions to these issues.
Marco Navoni, Senior Lecturer in the Finance Discipline Group at the University of Technology, Sydney Business School, speaking with Vincent Su. Well, that's it for On The Money this week. Thanks to producers Andrew Barclay, Mike Veyers, Tanya Katsanis and Vincent Su. You can find all our shows and stories at 2ser.com/onthemoney. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter, look for at onthemoney2ser, and please like us on Facebook as well. I'm Catherine Zangara. Thanks for your company. Mm-hmm.